Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra, extra special guest. What can I say? Ron Barron, founder of Barron Capital. He's a legend. I don't even know where to begin with this guy. He founded Barron Capital in 82. The performance numbers he's put up have just been obscene. Everything he does, he seems to find his way to just spectacular returns, whether it's public companies or private companies or real estate. Just Google search him on East Hampton and the property he bought for $100 million in the midst of the financial real estate collapse in 07. He turned that into gold. I mean, he just has an eye for intrinsic value and a process for doing things that really is just amazing. What I ended up doing in this conversation was kind of giving him a nudge and then just getting out of his way. He just tells all sorts of stories about how different investments work out. I ask him, what are you doing in the growth space? I really know you as a small cap guy. And that's how he built his reputation. And he describes the small caps that he bought when he was first getting started in the 80s, you know, small companies like Disney and Hyatt and International Gaming. And it's hilarious because 40 years ago, those were small cap companies. He just seemed to have a knack of identifying the companies that were about to go from relatively small to giant. And it's pretty hilarious to hear him discuss that when he was a broker in the 70s, he was upset because he would buy stocks, watch them triple and sell them, and then watch them go up 30x over the next 30 years, which is why his turnover ratio is insane. It's like 4%. He's very Warren Buffett-like. He never sells. He finds a good company and he rides them forever. So he's a legend in the industry. I found this to be just an endlessly entertaining and fascinating conversation. With no further ado, my conversation with Ron Barron.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My extra special guest this week is Ron Barron, founder of Barron Capital. He began the firm in 1982, and it has become known for its long-term fundamental active approach to growth investing. 17 of their mutual funds have assets of $49 billion. One of the funds run by Ron and his son Michael was up 148% in 2020. Nearly all of their funds have been beating their benchmarks since their inception way back in 1982. Ron Barron, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks, Barry.
So let's go way back to your childhood. You had written... You were 14 when you talked your father into letting you buy your first stock. You put $1,000 into the market, and by the time you hit college, it had quadrupled to $4,000, and you were hooked. You just began studying the market almost obsessively, right? Tell us a little bit about how that led to your interest in being a money manager.
Well, my dad was an engineer for the Army. And my mother was a buying agent for the Army, and so professionals. The people who were most successful were doctors and lawyers. And if you had a house on the on the lake. It was worth $50,000. Our house was worth $20,000. And so the guy I had on the lake, he owned rides on the boardwalk, drove a Cadillac, and probably made $100,000 a year. That, to me, was success. And So I wanted to be a doctor. I didn't get into medical school. When you were talking about the first investment, I've been working since I've been 14. That's when you got working papers. So my first job was as a caddy. I had all these summer jobs, caddy, waiter, busboy, lifeguard, water ski instructor, cabana boy. One summer, I actually had a job where I was working 9 to 5 as a lifeguard, and 11 to 7, I worked in the emergency room as an orderly. And people would come in on Saturday night, shot or stabbed, and I'd have to hold them down. A skinny little kid, I would hold them down on a gurney until the next of kin came and gave permission to operate. But people died while I was holding them. So my job was I would have to clean bedpans. I'd have to hold people on the gurney until they got permission to operate. And then in emergency, in the internal, in the ICU, when people died, I would unplug them, and I'd have to put the bodies, wrap them in sheets, and I'd have to put them in the freezer. That was my job. 11 to 7 for there, and 9 to 5. So I was always interested in being successful. I didn't know exactly what success was. And when I invested, when I convinced my dad to allow me to invest in stocks, he was never able to invest in stocks. When I convinced him, I was able to take my $1,000 I had from my bar mitzvah, and I ultimately invested it in Monmouth County National Bank. My dad said, you know, not the stock market, but, you know, tell me about a company you want to invest in. Explain to me why you want to invest in it. Research it. And if it makes sense to me, you can do it. And the local bank was owned, Monmouth County National Bank was principally owned by one of the wealthiest people in, probably the wealthiest person in my neighborhood. And he owned that bank, three-story red brick building, white pillars in front, Georgian-style building. Senator Stout from New Jersey had his office in the building. And ultimately, I looked at the company, and I convinced my dad to let me invest. And that's where I had my savings. And they were getting 2.5% interest or 2.25% interest. You bring in your passbook, and every quarter they print out your interest. So ultimately invested in that. And then I would go home. So I was interested in girls and sports. But every day I would look at the Asbury Park Press, and they had 10 or 15 local stocks. And every day from the time I invested my 100 shares at $10 a share, every single day the stock either stayed the same or went up an eighth or a 16th or a quarter, every single day. And then 7 months later, 8 months later, it was acquired for $17 when I paid $10 for it. And so all of a sudden my $1,000 became worth $1,700. I said, oh, my God, nothing to this. I want to do this. And so I wanted to be an investor somehow, and I would read about well-known investors, you know, Jerry Tsai with Manhattan Fund. And then I went to, then I graduated college, didn't get into medical school. I didn't want to go to Vietnam. I had a fellowship, a PhD fellowship at Georgetown, and I thought I would do that for a year in biochemistry. And ride my motorcycle, wear my white jacket, pretend I was a doctor. And so I did that for a year, and I was making $1,600 a year. And I was working as a bartender and a waiter at 1789 in Georgetown. And then the summer, on Fridays and Saturdays, to make extra money. And I was living in a basement in Rock Creek Park. And that summer, one of my friends who actually did get into medical school, my best friend, we said, okay, why don't we see if we can sell Fuller brushes? Maybe we can make money doing that. So we went into a neighborhood. We sold the record number of Fuller brushes. It was a black neighborhood, and we sold record number of Fuller brushes in Southeast Washington, I think it was. And then when we ultimately went back to deliver those brushes, there were no deposits, and people wouldn't even answer the door. You'd hear a little voice inside saying, Mommy, Mommy, it's the Fuller Brush Man, and they'd say, get away from the door. And said, not a single person took a brush that they bought. But this did change my life, because came to a building, high-rise, and it said, absolutely no soliciting. And so I said, okay, Bob, you start at the top, and I'll start at the bottom. we'll meet in the middle somewhere. You know, we just bang on doors. And so we bang on doors, and somewhere in the middle of the building, a guy answers a door, and he's a few years older than I am, and he's well-dressed. He has an apartment, and he has furniture, and he has windows that look out on the sky instead of, you know, standing on a chair to look out at grass, you know, because you're in the basement. And he's dressed nicely, and he has a wife, and he's cooking dinner for him in the kitchen. I say, how come you're not in Vietnam? He says, well, I'm working in the patent office. I'm a patent examiner. And I said, well, how do you do that? And he's making $11,000 a year. I said, how do you do that? And he said, well, you take the law boards, and if you get into law school, then you can get a job in the patent office as an examiner. And I said, okay, I want to. And she invites me in, buys some Fuller brushes, actually. But the big thing is, he tells me about, here's this critical skills job about, and that I can fit into, and starting salary was $7,729. I go from making $1,600 a year living in a basement to making $7,729 a year for the next 3 years and a draft exempt job. And I said, wow, that's great. So I took the boards, did real well, got into George Washington Law School, went to school at night and patent examined in the daytime. And then when I got to be 26, but I was always interested in the stock market. I read about it, never had any courses on it, never had any courses in economics, except for ECO 101 in college. And then, but I read all these books. And then I got to be 26, and I couldn't be drafted anymore. And the day after my birthday, I quit my job in the patent office, and they had a going-away lunch for me at the Holiday Inn, which I was late for, across the street from Crystal City in Virginia. I'm late for the lunch. I had a date, you know, girlfriend. And so I get there, and I'm late, and everybody understood where I was. And so I come in, my motorcycle, and everyone started joking around. And my boss was Mr. Liebman. Somehow he really liked me. He sort of identified with this crazy guy who was young and long hair and boots that he wore. But he liked me, and so he was always promoting me. But I was never very good as a patent examiner. But he said, so his speech, his going away speech to me at the patent office lunch to honor me for school, he says, Ron, he didn't like being a patent examiner so much. He was okay at it, but, you know, it wasn't his thing. But he's always been interested in the stock market. And that says he's going to go to New York and find his calling. But there was another patent examiner. He had the same idea where he also didn't like being a patent examiner so much. And that was a long time ago in the 1930s, and he lived in Switzerland or Germany, and that was Albert Einstein, and he did okay, and I expect Ron to do okay. So he was comparing me to Albert Einstein, and then I go to New York, and of course I'm now in debt $15,000. I was actually in debt $14,400. So I was $15,000 in debt, but I had $600 in cash. So I go to live again in a basement of one of my friends from college, from high school, And in Maplewood, New Jersey, and I would go every day to New York to try to knock on doors to interview for a job as an analyst. It was just impossible to get a job. 1969, I was unemployed for 3 months. I was running out of money. Told my dad, I'm never getting a job on Wall Street. I would apply for jobs as a chauffeur, thinking that for a guy who's the head of a Wall Street firm, thinking that, gee, if I can talk to him and if I can get a job for him, then maybe I can talk my way into some starter job there, like a mailroom guy or something. But no jobs. And ultimately, I convinced Tony Tabell from Delafield Harvey Tabell, which is part of Janet Montgomery Scott, to give me a chance. And I wrote it hired me in the fall of 1969. And I was the research department for Janney Montgomery Scott, a brokerage firm in Philadelphia. And they had 250 offices, 250 brokers in 5 offices. And Tony every week was in Princeton, which is where I lived with him, at his firm, Delafield Harvey Tabell. And what I would do is I would go He would every week pick stocks for me to go visit the companies. I'd go visit them, and I'd write a letter. And then the letter went to all the salesmen. And then, so I left Washington making $11,000 a year. And here I am making $15,000 a year. He promised me $18,000 by the end of the year. I didn't get the raise. And then I got fired because I wrote a negative report about a company that that ultimately went bankrupt, but I screwed up Jenny Montgomery Scott for being in the underwriting. And then it was very easy for me to get my next job. And Alan Abelson from Barron's, he was on my list for this letter that I wrote every week. And so I wrote a letter every week for Jenny Montgomery Scott, gave it to their salesman about the companies I've been to visit. I go to the 250 brokers in these five different offices or six offices, and that was what they sold to their clients every week, the companies I've been to visit. Ultimately, that was for 3 years, and then now I go to New York and get another analyst job, and then I went became partners with a friend of mine from law school, and we sold research to hedge funds. I had 100 clients ultimately, and hedge funds, mutual funds, anyone who is well known, I would do research and sell it to them for their commissions. And I went from having a negative net worth of $15,000 in 1970 to getting to making $1 million in a year in 1980 and being worth $1 million. And then 1982 started Barron Capital. At that time, we had $10 million under management. $10 million, that's with an M. And it was all from one person. It was Soros. And he had given six people who were his favorite stockbrokers in the 1970s, 76 or 77. He gave each of us $5 million. After he had a tough year, so they said, Quantum said, why don't you have some other people manage money for you instead of just you? And he picked his six favorite brokers, and I was one of them. And my $5 million became worth $10 million. And everyone else would buy and sell and trade. And my little segment of that Quantum fund was called Mandrake the Magician, Mandrake. And what I would do is I would just buy stuff, and I'd hold it. And that's why the $5 million became $10 million. And then 1992, we were up to 100, and we started our first mutual fund, 1987, Barron Asset Fund. And initially in 82, there were three people: Susan Robbins, Linda Martinson, and me. Then 1992 at 100 million, and maybe we were 10 people then. Now we have 100. Now we have 49.1 billion. And we've made our clients $47 billion in profits.
And wow, that's amazing.
And I've gone from having a negative net worth to $1 million net worth. And now Forbes says I'm one of the wealthiest people in the country. And I have 5.5% of the, $2.7 billion of the money that's invested in the mutual funds is me. That's my two sons.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
That's an amazing story. I have to ask this. So I know you primarily as a small cap manager. In fact, the Barron Small Cap Fund is up an average of 11.4% a year since its inception. Its benchmark is the Russell 2000, which is only up 7.4%. Let's discuss a little bit how you built your reputation originally around small caps. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Barron Small Cap Fund happens to be managed by Cliff Greenberg, not by me, and he's done terrific. And Barron Growth Fund is managed by me and with Neil Rosenberg. And the CAGR on that one, since that inception in 1994, is 14.16 compared to 9.04 for the Russell 2000, 10.5 for the S&P. And then, right. So all these funds, so starting off, the idea that we had originally, when I was still doing research in the 1970s and selling it for commissions, my ideas were smaller companies like McDonald's, Disney, Federal Express, Nike, Mattel, Hyatt. They were small companies, $1 billion, $2-3 billion market cap. And my idea was that I was getting about 1% in commissions for every idea that I had. And so I would go around, and if I got someone to spend $600,000 or $700,000 or $800,000 on a stock, I would make $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 in commissions. And then it didn't take me long to figure out, okay, well, if I got them to buy a stock for $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 commission, then if I got them to sell a stock, then I would make another $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 in commissions. That was that was how I paid the rent. And then after about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, I looked back and I said, man, I am a disaster. I looked at all these companies I invested in, and they had gone up so much. And I said, I could have been rich. You know, I said, all these things. What am I, crazy looking at these things and selling them so quick? And you know, I invested in Dalen with Ken Langone. And he calls me up one day and he says, hi, I'm Ken Langone. We went to college together. He's about 10 years older than I am, 8 years older than I am. Went to Bucknell. And he said, you know, people like us, we got to stay together. I said, people like us, what are you talking about? And so he says, why don't we go to lunch? And so we go to lunch at, I guess it was lunch at the Waldorf. And it was the Bull and Bear restaurant, which he was in. And so I knew him. He didn't, you know, and he said, look, you're buying this company, Dalen, and I'm buying it. It just had come out of bankruptcy. And it was run by a guy named Sanford Sigaloff. And there were two guys who had a business inside of that I thought was really cool. Marcus and what was the other guy's name? They both ran Handy Dan. Ultimately became Home Depot. Right. And so I invest in this company for my clients. And Ken is investing in Celsius. Ron, you're just killing me. Every time I see something, you fight me for the stock. Why don't we just do something where we split things? You take half and I'll take half. I said, fine, that sounds good to me. And if I see something, I'll show it to you. You see something, you show it to me. And we'll split it 50-50. I said, great. He was buying it for himself. I was buying it for my clients. And the stock goes from $2 to $4 or $5 a share. I sell all my stock because I make commission selling. And he hangs on. And then ultimately, he refinances the whole thing. And those guys who were running Handy Dan get fired. And then you go to Ken. He raises the money for him and builds Home Depot. That's Home Depot. That's where it comes from. And if I had been an investor and I stayed with it, you know, it would have been so much earlier for me to be successful. But small companies that other people weren't following so much, that are growing real fast, and that's where we focused. Last week or the week before, and I'm writing about this in my current quarterly letter. I got a phone call from Chuck Matheson. And the same thing happened with me with him, where I guess in the 80s, and he and I were both buying International Game. And the market cap was $100 million. He was buying it to take it over. I was buying it to make brokerage commissions. And he calls me up and he says, why don't we? And it was the same kind of split thing. I said, fine. And so I make my doubles or triples or quadruples or something, and he stays with it. And it goes from $100 million of market cap to $10 billion. $10 billion, $100 million to $10 billion. He told me I was the only guy ever really understood what this megabucks was and how important it was and how it was just linking up all these slot machines and all these different casinos. And ultimately, like in I guess it was around the 2000s, then the government, the Senate, Spitzer in New York wanted to have independent directors for independent chairman for mutual funds. And Chuck became the chairman of our mutual fund company, a Barron Funds, for 5 years. And we wanted to have an independent director. independent executive chairman. And so he calls me up about, and now he's in his hobby, 85, 90 years old, and he's retired, and he's living in Reno. And last time I saw him was about a year ago, 2 years ago, and he's visiting a plant, a Tesla plant in Reno, and he invites me over and spent an afternoon with him. It was so much fun. But he calls me up, and he's now chairman emeritus for Barron Funds and chairman emeritus also for International Game. And he calls me up and says, Ron, congratulations on Tesla. He says, you know, I never thought this would work. And, you know, you were right, and you hung in there, and everyone was criticizing you, and you believed, and you were right, and I was wrong, and everybody else was wrong. You made, you know, congratulations on that. And then I'm talking to my trader, who's been working at Barron Capital since 1987, I think he told me. And I'm talking to him about the conversation that Chuck had with me. Oh, yeah, Chuck, the way he starts the conversation is, he says, you know, when I first met you in the 1980s, all you were talking about was investing in wireless telephones. And he says, and this is how I start off my next shareholder letter, the letter from Ron. It's, Ron, here's the quote. Ron, when I first met you 35 years ago, you were investing in wireless telephones. Wow, that's a pretty far-out idea, I thought. That's Chuck. So he's thinking, I'm in the 1980s, and I'm investing in U.S. Cellular and McCaw Cellular and Lynn Broadcasting and George Lindemann's Metro Mobile. And he says, man, that's crazy. Wireless telephones? I was thinking about Maxwell Smart. Get smart on television. You know, you take off your shoe and you talk into your shoe. And of course, wireless phones, that's become, you know, everything. And then I was talking to David, our trader, about conversations. And he says, you know, and I was talking about Tesla, and Chuck just called to congratulate me about Tesla. And he says, Ron, you always invested in things like this. You know, when I first joined you in the 1980s, you were talking about cellular telephones. You had just gotten back with Judy from a vacation in Italy, a week vacation in Italy, and you just said, man, everywhere I go, people are talking on these little cell phones. This is going to be unbelievable. I have, you know, whether you're rich or whether you're poor. And that time, you know, we had bought when we started Barron Capital, I bought a telephone, 1982. I bought one. It was $5,000. It was a briefcase, the size of a briefcase. And now it's late 80s, and they're down to smaller phones. They look like a, you know, a brick or something, the size of a brick. And he said, and you were talking about it then, and that's all you wanted to invest in then, and all these companies. So you always invested in those kind of things. And so the idea was initially, to invest in companies that were worth more than they were selling for in the stock market. And if you could buy a hotel room, for example, or you know, if it cost you $100,000 to build and you made $10,000 a year after you built it, and you could buy it in the stock market for $70,000, and then it would go to the value, that's how it started. And then, you know, when I went out on my own, I figured that was the safe thing to do. I didn't, you know, it's like Warren Buffett's thing where you buy the cigarette butts on the street. And Mario Gabelli, you know, it's about, you know, buying things, you know, discounted cash flow. But that wasn't really what I loved doing. I loved finding these businesses that could grow tremendously from what they were now. So it started off finding smaller companies that people ignored. But then what would happen is that, you know, out of the 10 things that you bought, two or three would be amazing successes. And then, you know, a few of them would be sort of ordinary. And the more you bought of them, the harder it was to sell them to get out at the other side. And then there were always, you're left over with things that, you know, how do you get out of them? And the answer was you don't. So I was not that interested in that, and I wanted to have a business that was going to last for a long time. And so again, going back to my parents, I wanted to have a business that people like my parents would be able to invest in the stock market. You know, and because I always believed, and So, I always believe in this sort of thing. And the idea behind the mutual funds was that here's a way that I would be able to give a service to people like my parents so they could save for their retirement and their life events. I got a phone call about, so we have a house in Long Island and one in Florida where I am now, and then of course we live in New York. And in our house in Long Island, one of my sons and his wife were staying there about a month or two ago, and we get a, and he calls me up and he said, "Dad, I just got four bottles of Dom Perignon from he tells me who it's from, and I said, "Oh wow, Bob, he worked with me when I was at Hertzfeld and Stern from 73 to 82. He was a retail stockbroker, and he sends me four bottles of Dom Perignon. I said, "Man, that's a lot of money. I got to call him to thank him. I can't understand why he would send me, you know, champagne." I call him up, and he says, "Ron, when 73 to 82, when you were working at Hertzfeld and Stern, and then ultimately you and Susan, who was my assistant, left. Susan is now vice president of Barron Capital, and she's our healthcare analyst, and left. And I said, "I have to invest." And you were selling your research to hedge funds and institutions, and I saw what you were doing. And I have retail brokers. I'm a retail broker, and they were my clients. I piggybacked on some of your ideas. But I said, "Well, if I have a chance to invest with you, I am going to invest with you." And so when you started your first fund in 87, I invested in it. And then in 1992, when you started Barron Partners Fund, it sounded like a very cool idea. So I did something that I never do, and I advise my clients they should never do. I borrowed $200,000 to invest in Barron Partners Fund. I had to invest with you. And so he put in the $200,000, and then he said, and then after it doubled or tripled, I sold half of it, and I left the other $100,000 in. And the other $100,000 that I took out, I put that into this little fund of funds called Castle, which I wanted to, which we had at Barron Funds, at Barron Capital, for some of the employees to invest in, some of the people who I was friends with. And then some of it I was doing myself. And so he says, and then that $100,000 left in Barron Partners Fund, that is now over 40,000 shares of Barron Partners Fund. It's worth over $7 million. So the $100,000 became worth over $7 million. And then the $100,000 I took out, that became worth $1.7 million. And he says, and basically, I want you to know that you've paid for my son to go to medical school. He just graduated from medical school. You've paid for him to go to medical school. In addition to that, I have another child who's disabled, and I never really understood how I was going to take care of him for the rest of my life. And you've taken care of him for the rest of my life. So there isn't anything that you could do that I wouldn't believe in. And I walked down the street. You know, my youngest son got married last September, a year and a half ago, and they're from Virginia Beach, and his parents came up, of course, for the wedding and everything. We had a wedding at our house, and when they came to our office, and when we're walking home from our office in the General Motors building to our apartment, as we're walking up Madison Avenue, two people jumped out of doorways to say, "Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Ron." And Jenna's mother, who I'm walking with, Judy's walking with her dad, she says, "Does this always happen to you?" I said, "It's unbelievable, all over the place. People are always saying thank you. When we have our annual meeting, they come out of our conference afterwards, is the same thing, where they say, "Gee, you know, thank you for my life. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for." It's amazing. One of my this guy who I was telling you about, Ray Novak, actually, who's my high school friend, who was living in Maplewood when I was living in his basement trying to get a job on Wall Street. He's now a director of Barron Funds, and he has been for 25, 30 years. And he calls me up, and he says, you know, I'm 77 now, and I've been investing with you since the very beginning. And thank you for all this. I don't have to think about stuff anymore. And I was, for a while, I was trying to pick stocks, and, you know, because I read a lot, and so I can't pick stocks. I come to your meetings, you know, to the board meetings every 3 months, and I see what you're doing, and I listen to the analysts you have working for you. There's 172 people now at Barron Capital, and 41 or 42 are analysts and portfolio managers. They've been there a really long time, not all of them a long time. We hire one or two people a year, three sometimes. And we hire 10 or 15 people a year in total. And, they could be in risk management, or they can be legal, accounting, compliance, sales. All these IT. I wouldn't have any clue as far as what we need to hire. I know what I need to hire for the research, but all these other people. So I'm in charge of 40 people, and Linda Martinson, who is the third employee, Susan Robbins and I, and Linda, she's the president of the firm and chairman of the mutual funds, or she has all these different titles, and chief operating officer, and she's the one who hires all these other people that we need. And initially, other guys there would say, why are we hiring risk? What is that all about? What is this attribution? What do those people do? And always, saying and thinking, gee, if we're hiring all these other people, then that means that I'm going to make less money. And so, because some of that money is going to them instead of to me. That's the mindset that people have when a business grows and everyone thinks that it's growing because they're great. Of course, they are great. But everyone thinks everything is because of them until they go home at night and think about it and they say, ow, now maybe it's not all because of me. But then all of a sudden...
That's right. Smaller piece of a bigger pie.
Yeah. But then all of a sudden everyone says, gee, I can't write my shareholder letters without talking to Claudia. And so Claudia is this a young woman who went to MIT and math, and she has all this risk metrics and everything that she looks at and explains things to me. But she can explain where we're making money and where we're not. And Ron, you've taken this much risk. And for me, I don't really care that much about... I have to see where I'm making and where I'm losing and to make sure that things don't get too out of whack. But for the most part, Henry Fernandez from MSCI, so he invites me to speak to his board of directors, and he says, he wants to talk about capital allocation and about investments that he should be making, and should he be buying back stock, or should he be paying out dividends, or should he be making acquisitions, or what should he be doing, and do I like it? Do I like this? And I talk to the board, but he says, most of the things that we do, I mean, that's not what you do. You're an investor. I mean, you find companies that you think are going to become dramatically. And MSCI, so Henry says, Ron, I would not have a public company were it not for you. In 2009, when I'm going public, or 2008, when I'm going public, I couldn't go public without you doing it. So he's an immigrant. His parents, his dad was a general in Venezuela. And there was a change, a coup, and they had to flee from the country, and he goes to Morgan Stanley. That's what Morgan Stanley, MSCI. And he starts the business, and then ultimately Morgan Stanley lets him bring it public. But when he goes public, the market isn't receptive, but we invest in the company. And then the stock doubles, and then it goes back down, and now we've made about 20 times our money. And he said, I often ask myself, how is it, some other guys at Barron Capital sold, but you didn't. You always bought more, and you hung in there the whole time. And other people were criticizing for know, this acquisition or that. But you understood the strategy of what we were trying to accomplish. And while that's not, you know, you're not competing against an index, you beat the indexes all the time, but, you know, not every single year, but over the long term, you kill them. And, all the things I described to everyone else about, volatility and standard deviation, just everything I described to everyone else, that's important that they need to have. You're an investor. You find these businesses, and whether it goes up or down, you don't think about it. Jay Pritzker, who was one of the people who was the first, you know, really mentor when I was starting, and mm-hmm. and he told me, and I was an investor in Hyatt then, and he told me once. He says, "Ron, you know more about Hyatt than I know about Hyatt." He says, "You know, but the idea was about trying to understand the businesses in which we're investing so well that you can just ride through it." And he would tell me, he says, "I don't ever think about the price of a stock, but during the day, you know, during the year. The only time I ever think about stock prices is when I'm either going to buy or whether."
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm going to sell.
Let's talk a little bit about how you put the long in long-term investing. A couple of names: you've owned Charles Schwab since 1992, Choice Hotels since 96, Vail Resorts since 97. Where do you get the conviction to be so long-term in your core holdings?
There's something about every business, the most important element of a business, you know, of course, they got to grow, and you really got to like and trust the people. But what is important is about competitive advantage. What is it about these businesses in which you've invested, which we've invested, that gives them a chance to last for a long time and gives them pricing power? In the case of Charles Schwab, that was we had a mutual fund business, and in 1992 we had $100 million in management. 50 was the mutual fund, 50 was separate accounts. We could not make that business grow. 87, we had $50 million in a mutual fund. 1992, we had $50 million in a mutual fund. We couldn't make it grow. And all of a sudden, we get into Charles Schwab on the platform side. We learn about financial advisors. We learn about, I had no idea who they were, like you, and RIAs. And we learn about them, and we learn that they're clearing through Schwab, and they have, Schwab has a platform, the mutual fund marketplace, and then they had one source. And we got on, people who were advisors to recommend to Charles Schwab, which was for $20,000, they would have to do the work, and they weren't sure they were going to have a worthwhile spend on us. And where was the demand? So we got a whole bunch of people to call. They said, "Okay, we'll put you on." And when they put us on, and we started, they said, "A lot of people know who you are, but didn't know how to buy what we're selling." And we got on the platform. Our fund did well. We got recommended. We got one of the top fund choices. And all of a sudden, where we couldn't get any money coming in, starting at $10,000 a day, $50,000 a day, $100,000 a day. And then we started growing. And so when I saw that happening, and it all came from Schwab, I said, "Wow, I better really study Charles Schwab." And I studied Charles Schwab, and I saw that people were leaving big brokerage firms to go on their own, and then use Charles Schwab to clear, and they didn't want to sell the product that the brokerage firms that they were working for were asking them to sell, or they didn't want to just raise money. They wanted to have their own business, and so it made sense to me, and I really liked Chuck. In fact, he was just being honored fairly, the last few years, at some restaurant downtown, and he invited me to be one of the people at this lunch, at this dinner. And then, I don't know, maybe 100 people were there, 150 people. And see, they, I was up there, and he said, and he calls me out from the podium about how, you know, people like Ron Barron were able to be offered to his clients, which was a really good deal. So to Charles Schwab, they're responsible. It would be crazy for me to have a business like ours that couldn't grow, and all of a sudden we get this platform and grow, and for me not to realize that was a really big opportunity. I had to invest in it. So we invested in it. We made 50 times our money, 60 times our money so far.
So far, are you still long Charles Schwab all this time?
Yes.
That's 30 years ago.
Less than a dollar a share.
Wow, now, that's amazing. I know your turnover rate is about 5 to 7%, and the Barron Growth Fund, the average turnover is under 3%. That very much stands out compared to your peers who often have turnover rates of 50 or 100% or even more than 100%. They'll turn over a whole portfolio, you know, twice a year. What are the advantages of the buy and sell approach that you've embraced?
Oh, and I was describing to you before about Disney and McDonald's and Federal Express and Nike in the 1970s. If I had remained an investor in all those companies, they were up 50, 60. And we were investing in Disney in the 1970s when they were building Disney World in Florida. So they had Disneyland in California, which was 5,000 acres, and everyone around them built other properties and made all that extra money, and you know, in the orange groves in California. And in Florida, they said, okay, we're doing this differently this time. Instead of having 5,000 acres where we just have a park, we're going to buy 100,000 acres, and we're going to have hotels. We're going to have all the other services. We're going to get the money from that. So I was investing in Disney in the 1970s when they were building Disneyland, Disney World. I was investing in McDonald's at a time when I would go, you know, my girlfriend at the time was in Washington. And when I would go down to Washington, I would go, you know, every weekend she would come to New York, or I would go to Washington. And Big Macs, I couldn't wait to go have Big Macs. And they were like less than a dollar. They were 75, 80 cents, I don't know. And I felt that with McDonald's, the big opportunity was that they were they owned the land that was underneath of the franchisee's properties. And the Coca-Colas were then 10 cents for a Coke. Maybe fries were 10 cents. Maybe the hamburgers were 20 or 25 cents. I said, oh, my God, the profit margin that they're on the verge of making, they could raise the price from 10 to 15 cents, and then all of a sudden that extra 5 cents is all profit. Or they can raise the price of fries from 10 cents to 12 cents, or apple pie that they had from 15 cents to 20 cents. So I thought there was a tremendous amount of leverage in the pricing that they had. And plus they had this land and underneath of all of the hotels. So there's something about the business that felt Vail was the best mountain I had ever seen. Ski. I love skiing. And it was the best mountain. Other people would have 600 acres. Aspen was 600 acres. Vail was 14,000 acres. And the big opportunity in Vail was that when we invested in it in 1976, it was $16 or $17 a share. And then what happened in Vail is that it was controlled by a man named George Gillette, who borrowed against the property and then built a radio station in Tallahassee, I guess it was, or somewhere in Florida, and borrowed $250 million and bankrupt. Leon Black bought the debt and turned into the equity. And then brought the company public so he could pay back some of the money that he borrowed to buy this. And the stock was $16 or $17. And then my idea was...
And you've been older ever since.
Well, ever since, yes. And what I did was that when he distributed his stock at $30 a share in 2006 to all of his partners, I knew a lot of his partners. In fact, one of his partners is one of my friends. His name is Billy Mack, Mack Cali Real Estate. In fact, I was just talking to him the other day. We were playing golf in Florida. And he said, you know, I only know a few stocks. I know your Tesla you told me about. I know iridium. I bought iridium when you told me to buy iridium. It was $7 a share. It's now $47. And then Vail, I was an investor with Leon. And then when he sold his distributed all his stock at $30 or $28, I came to you because you were buying the stock. And I said, what should I do? And you told me, I told him, I said, Billy, what you should do is you should buy all the stock you can buy at this price. But if you want to sell your stock, I want to buy your stock. And so all those guys who I knew from Leon Black from Apollo were selling the stock. I bought it all. And so we bought 10 or 12% of the company around $30 a share. It's now 270 or 280, something like that. Geez. But the big idea was that it was the best place you could ski, and there had been nothing done in the town to regentrify it. And that was a town built in the 1980s, about 1980. And it would really decrepit, and the places would be junky, and you would stay there, and you'd pay $500 or $1,000 a night, and then you go skiing on a mountain for $45. And I said, if you made this town better, buy, sell, you know, build and then sell, build and sell, build and sell, then what would happen is that the town would be so great, and everyone would come there, and we would be happy to spend anything you charge to stay in the town, even if you didn't own it. But we make all the money on this on the mountain. Instead of $45 a day, you can earn $100 a day. And so he thought that was too risky, but he asked me to make a presentation to the board. I said, I'm not an active investor. I'm not trying to make you do things. But this is the way you should. He said, Ron, too much risk. I just want to fix it up and sell it. And he did. And then all the people got their stock. And then what happened is that the new person comes in, Rob Katz. Rob, I got so lucky with him. And Rob, all the ideas that I had about building and selling, building, he took off, and he did. And in addition to that, he took a ski pass, and now he sells more than half of the tickets in advance before the season even starts, before you know if it's going to snow. And as a result of that, we have half the ski passes sold, and he bought a network of mountains that he can sell, for example, in the Northeast. Now he can sell people, go skiing in Vail, from the Northeast. They couldn't get there before, and now they can buy the tickets there. And so he has all this money in the till. And then what happens is that instead of charging $100 that I wanted to charge, he now charges $200 to ski on the mountain. And then he has this whole network that he it's a feeder for the ski pass tickets. But the best mountain, and he's got the best distribution system, and it's a great brand. And he's a spectacular manager.
So, Ron, I get the sense that your experience as a stockbroker buying and selling those companies that kept going up even after you sold it very much impacted how you behave as a mutual fund manager. You learned you had such a terrible experience selling winners in the 70s that in the 80s and 90s you decided I just can't get rid of these really good companies with great growth prospects.
Yes, that's it. That's the whole idea. And if they have competitive advantage, the big picture I have is that my parents, so when we bought, when I was 5 years old, and so I'm born in 1943, and we live in a, that was during the war, and we're living in my parents and I, of course, I didn't know what I was doing. I'm a year old. We're living in Red Bank, New Jersey, in three rooms owned by a Rassus, who is a Helen Rassus. Her husband's fighting in the war, and my dad's working for the Army. And we're living in these three rooms. And in 1944, we go live in Bradley Beach, which is just south of Asbury Park. And we live in a garage apartment, a detached garage apartment, where it's so small that they have to have the refrigerator. It doesn't fit in the kitchen. It's outside on the porch. So we lived there till 1948. And in 48, my parents buy their first house for $5,000 in Wanamassa, also outside of Asbury Park, $5,000. Then in 1955, they sell it for $10,000 to build a $20,000 house in West Allenhurst, also outside of Asbury Park. So those houses, for example, I went back 3 or 4 or 5 years ago to see those houses, 1122 Grassmere Avenue and 542 Deal Parkway. And I go look at those houses, and the house on in Wanamassa. That's the one they sold for $10,000. It was every single house on the street was the same. They're coming back after World War II. They're all the same. They were like, one was yellow and one was brown and one had a little brick front and one had a carport. They're all the same. And my house was the second from the corner. It was the nicest house in the block. I was so proud. It had a little, you know, a little fence around the front yard, maybe a quarter acre house. And they had put a dormer on the roof. So therefore some extra rooms. I'm standing there looking at this house, taking pictures of it. And a big giant guy comes to the door. I didn't want him to shoot me or something, thinking that, you know, who is this guy? So I go up to him and I say, you know, I'm Ron Barron. And this was, I was the one who lived in this house for the, just when it was built, a brand new house. And he said, oh, I know your name, actually. And I said, wow. And it turned out that this guy is a construction guy and his wife is a nurse. And he said, and he works at night. And, he says, come on in. I couldn't come in because they had dogs, and I were afraid of dogs. But I said, what's this house worth? He says, $300,000. I said, wow, my parents sure made a bad sale. And then I go to the other house that they on Deal Parkway in West Allenhurst, the same thing. That was the one they built for $20,000, and they sold ultimately for $100,000 when my dad retired. That's also worth $300,000, $350,000, $400,000. And so I think about it in terms of inflation. And when I was young and I thought $100,000 for the guy who lived on the corner and drove a Cadillac and we had an old Ford, and he had a house on the lake and we had a house in the middle of the block in a quarter acre or something like that. I said, and he owned rides on the boardwalk and a real estate guy. And I said, boy, I want to be successful like that. But again, $100,000. That was all the money in the world. And they had a $50,000 house. And so I said, how do you have that? And so the concept of inflation, the concept of what things cost. When I graduated college in 1965, my last year in college was, my everything was $3,500. When my first year was $2,200. My kids, it was $50,000 or $60,000, $70,000. When my grandchildren are going to the school right now, they're 6 and 8 years old, and I think their school must be $50,000 a year, $60,000 a year. They don't get to school anymore. It's virtual. So whether it's a car, when I bought a 240Z when I came to New York, for $2,000 or $2,500, and now they're $20,000 or $30,000 for these cars. So
more than that.
Yeah, and my salary of $7,729 when I was a patent examiner, those are now $60,000, $70,000. So my big picture is that the value of your money falls in half every 17 years. So if you have $100,000 today. In 17 years, you have $50,000 of buying power. In 17 more years, at 25, 17 more years, it'll be 12. So basically, I think that the stock market is the hedge against the devaluation of your currency. So the stock market basically doubles every 10 or 12 years. So historically, it's about 10% a year, including dividends. So it's 2 or 3, and that's because it keeps up with the economy, 2 or 3% real, 3 or 4% inflation. People say there's no inflation. You go try to hire someone for the same price that they paid last year, and you'll find out how much inflation is.
But, Ron, let me tell you a little bit about a bad sale you made. Those 240Zs, that car you had, they've become very collectible and nice versions of them today. From the 70s, nice versions go for $80,000, $90,000,
$100,000. Wow. Well, you know, when I bought it, this must be in 1970. Then what happened is that the list price was $2,500, and right. But there was a waiting list. They had mispriced it. There's a waiting list on those cars, and you had to pay the dealer cash, you know, a bribe. You had to give them $300 or $400 or $500. So basically, it cost me $3,000 for a $2,500 list price car, so I can get it immediately. But an orange car, and then two or three or four years later, the price had gone up, and I sold the car. I bought it for $3,000 when it was listed for $2,500, and after I owned it for three or four years, I sold it for $3,200, $3,300. I sold it for more than I paid for it, and I paid over list when I bought it originally. So it doesn't surprise me, I guess, that $80,000?
Yes. So what they do with those cars is they do a full frame-off restoration. They take them apart down to the last nut and bolt and then rebuild them. They're practically brand new 40-year-old cars.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Ron, you had mentioned Matt Calley earlier. I want to share a quote of yours about real estate that I found intriguing. Quote, "We believe there is a strong case to allocate capital to real estate in the public markets in an actively managed strategy." So let's discuss how you do that. How do you actively manage real estate investments in the public markets?
So we have a mutual fund is probably 10 years old. I think it must be, it's certainly in the top 1% of real estate mutual funds. And instead of just investing in REITs, we invest in companies that are C-Corps. And it can be a hotel business like a Hyatt, for example, or it can be a service business like CoStar, which enables people to walk around and buy apartments, rent apartments. You know, when you walk by the building, it'll show you, instead of looking at the newspaper for an apartment that might be for sale, you can actually walk by one and you can look at it on your iPad and you can see what that apartment, whether it's available and how much the rent is, and go in and rent it. And or it could be a Trex where it's going out there and building, decks over again with wood that's composite, and it's better than the traditional wood, lasts longer and looks more attractive. So it's not just investing in REITs, or it can be investing in a gaming company, like a Penn Gaming, which has sold the real estate that it owns but operates the properties. Now you have a play in Penn. And I've been investing with Peter Carlino in Penn Gaming since Three Mile Island, right after, there was I don't remember what year it was, but it was the 1970s, I think, somewhere, where, there was a nuclear explosion at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania and in Harrisburg, and went to visit him sometime after that. He was going public for the first time. I think the market cap on his company was $25 or $30 million. He ultimately sold the company for $7 billion. So you find these people, and that you can trust, and you think are really capable. You know, do I really? Would I trust this person to manage money for my family? Is that something I would feel comfortable choosing them to be someone who would be in charge of the assets that my family has if I wasn't here? And so it's the same kind of idea. So what we're doing is, like with Peter Carlino, there isn't anything this guy told me that he's ever not performed. And Stuart Bainum from Choice Hotels, there isn't anything. I know Stuart Bainum 1,000 times. When I was in the patent office in Washington, I borrowed, I had to get $2,000 because ManorCare was going public in 1969. That was a company his father had started. And ManorCare was a nursing home company. And I had read about 1965. They had the nursing homes, the Medicare. I kind of figured out some way. And Washington Post wrote these stories about it. I said, I got to invest in that company. And so I borrowed $2,000 to get a margin account. And $1,000 from the Patent Office Credit Union, $300 from Household Finance, $300 from Beneficial Finance. Somehow I came up with another $400. I have no idea how. But I had the, I got the $2,000 to open up an account. I think the firm was called Reynolds and Company. And invested in ManorCare. And ManorCare was ultimately went up 1,000 times from 1,000 times. Since then, the company had a book value of $12 million when it went public, and it came public at $20 million when it was first trade, you know, IPO, $20 million. That's the value of the whole company. It was, we became, in the 1970s, I was recommending the stock to my institutional clients. In the 1980s, we became the largest institutional shareholder of ManorCare, and it was sold ultimately for Carlyle Group for $4.5 billion. 4.3, 4.4, 4.5, something like that. But before it was sold, Choice Hotels came out. So we got Choice Hotels is now at $100 stock, and our cost is maybe originally $3. So, and Stuart Bainum, one of those people, anything he said, whether it's good or bad, Jay Pritzker was one of those people. Anything they said, Pritzker used to say to me, is Ron, you know, I would talk to him about contracts, and he would say, Ron, contract doesn't mean anything. If you have to have a contract to enforce an agreement, you're doing business with the wrong person, because that right. just because any good lawyer can break any single contract you have. So you have to look. You only have the contract so you can keep track of what the deal was, not so you can expect to enforce it.
So Ron, let's talk a little bit about one of your bigger holdings. You've been a buyer of Tesla since 2014. The stock has just exploded. Last year, it was up over 600%. Is there any upside left here? Where do you think the stock goes from here?
Well, we bought stock in Tesla. We spent $385 million between 2014 and 2016 to buy 8 million shares, 8 million one shares. And the average price is $40 a share, $42 a share. It's now $850. And so it's now $850 billion market cap. It was $42, $45 billion when we started. I think that in, and I've been saying this for a while, when we bought it, I thought that we would make 20 times our money. We've made 20 times our money. And so far. And I think that it's going to be a $2 trillion company over the next 10 years, 8 or 10 years. That's $2,000 a share. And wow. Can we get lucky? Yeah, I can get lucky. And for this autonomous driving takes off the way I think it could be, that could be worth another $500 billion or trillion dollars. Ride sharing could be a really big deal. The solar roofs, that could be a nice business for them. The battery business. Now, when they build factories, the factories they build are for 250,000 cars a year production. And a factory, when they built them in California, when they built it in the first one in Fremont, that was about $17,000 of capital spending a car. It's now in China about $4,000 a car. And the factory in China is probably at 250,000. People thought it was going to be 150,000 car a factory, and that was the opportunity people perceived. But we thought that they could do millions of cars a year in China. And that one factory they built so far is a 250,000 car factory a year, which is now at the rate it's producing. That's making somewhere around $2.5 billion a year. So they invested $1 billion. That's making $2.5 billion. When you invested in McDonald's a long time ago, you could invest $1 million as a franchisee, and if you worked, you know, crazy hours and you know, put on your apron and got all dirty, maybe you can make $250,000 a year for $1 million investment. These guys have $1 billion investment. They're making $2.5 billion a year. Pretty wild. I mean, wow. Like Steve Wynn when he goes into China and they spend $2 billion on the first hotel in Macau, and they gave him. They were so happy that he came. He gave him land that he sold for $1 billion. He has $1 billion net, and he started making it $100 million a month. But this is Tesla. They make $1 billion investments, and they make $2.5 billion a year. They're going to do the same thing in Germany, same thing in Texas.
What about SpaceX, which Elon Musk also
Wait, one more thing. And in Tesla, the battery business, which I think the car business could be a $600 or $700 billion business in revenues a year, and making $200 million a year, $200 billion a year in 10 years. So that's how you get to this $2 trillion value. But that's not including the batteries. He thinks that the battery can be also a business as big as the car business. So think about that. So here he thinks he's going to go from 500,000 cars a year to 20 million cars a year, and he thinks his battery business is going to be as big as his car business. So I'm talking about the $2 trillion because of the cars. I'm not talking about it for the batteries. As far as SpaceX, what that is that that's a business that we're an investor. We own a little bit less than 1%. It's a private company. And the value on it is $43 billion maybe. And that was where we started with Tesla. I think that SpaceX is on the way to $2 trillion also. So I think that in Tesla, we're going to make a triple in 10 years. I think that in SpaceX, we're going to make 30 to 50 times in 10 years.
Wow.
And one of the big reasons for that is that since the 1960s, when we started, you know, when President Kennedy said we're going to the moon, and the rockets that he used, they were disposable, $100 million rockets, $200 million rockets, they used one time, and then it burns up. When I was working in the patent office, by the way, just as a little aside here, when one of the things I did was I gave the patents on the coatings that were used on the capsules that returned to Earth. So all those capsules, to make them not burn up, I was the one who gave the patents on that stuff. It's just amazing.
Full circle.
And so with SpaceX, the competitive advantage that they have, the competitive advantage that Tesla has is battery stuff. The competitive advantage that SpaceX has is that they can use the rockets over and over again. So the fuel to get into outer space is maybe in orbit, maybe $500,000, $1 million, and the rockets are $100-200 million. They're throwing away $100-200 million instead of just spending the fuel over and over again. So now Tesla, the invention that they have is that they use the rockets over and over and over again. And so everyone said, man, you can't do that. And, landing a rocket on a platform in the ocean that's moving, they can use it again and again. That's insane. Nobody could do that. That's like dropping a pencil from your hand, landing on an eraser, and it's standing up. Doesn't work. He did it. And so So if someone else is going to do it, China, when they were successful at this, at landing these rockets, China had an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, and they said, congratulations, Elon Musk, but boy, our brilliant Chinese engineers, you're really missing out. You're getting beaten, not by a country, you're getting beaten by a guy. What's the matter with you? You got to catch up. Editorial in the Wall Street Journal was, we think we are, I don't remember if it's 5 years behind or 10 years behind, but way behind Elon Musk, not behind the United States, behind Elon Musk. So the idea here is that there's 7 billion people on Earth, or 7.5 billion, and half of them don't have internet. And if you happen to live in East Hampton or Vail or even Palm Beach, there's not good reception for internet. And so the big opportunity in the relatively short term is that they can get have very low cost of launch. So Elon Musk owns 52% of the company, Google owns 7, we own a little bit less than 1, and I think that this internet to the broadband from satellite to your home is going to be an unbelievable business. Unbelievable. And because there's so many people that need it. So this is like a utility. This is like water, and this is like electricity. You've got to have broadband. And if you want to cut down on the inequality that's present in the world, you got to have people educated. The way you're getting educated is with broadband.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.
Huh. Do you own any other non-public companies, or is SpaceX the only private firm your Barron Funds invests in?
We own Rivian, which is another electric car company, a small position in that. And that's owned 20% by Amazon. And we have a small position in that. We're just investing right now in Cruise. That's another private company that's going to do a car service with autonomous driving in San Francisco and very shortly. That's about to start. We're investors in that. And then we're investors in a couple of small investments. We're investor in a battery company, the Goldman Sachs, also a very small investment. Barron Growth Fund has this investment. The big problem with electric vehicles is where the battery's coming from. And and this company, Goldman Sachs, sponsored, and Volkswagen is the big customer for making these batteries in Europe and using hydropower, Norway hydropower. And then a farmers network to allow farmers to get better seed at lower prices. We're investor in that. So we have a bunch of small investments. But we have in Barron Growth Fund, for example, about a bunch of investments that we've invested, $10, $20 million, that are worth $200 million, $300 million. There was I had sold a little bit of Tesla, and I wanted people to see what I'm doing, so they don't think that I've died, and the only reason we still own Tesla is because I'm dead. So I put a note up on our website that said that what happened is that it became a very large percentage of a few funds that we manage, Barron Partners Fund, Barron Focus Growth Fund, one offshore fund that we have. And so as a result of that, I decided it would be prudent for me as a business owner, not just as an investor in a company, to show people that actually we do take profits on occasion. And, when something, not because there's something wrong with the business or because I'm afraid about the volume, the volatility in the stock, but rather because I want to show people that we're responsible. So out of the 8 million shares that we have, 8,000,001 shares, we sold 500,000 shares for our clients at 450 and 500,000 shares. Remember, our cost is 41. 500,000 shares at 650 and 250,000 shares at 850. And so basically, it's painful every time I've sold it, but the people just say, gee, how can you, don't you ever sell? What's the matter with you? So what I did in Tesla is that I said that, I'm not buying stocks. I only invest in our mutual funds. And that was the commitment I made. And since 1992, with a couple of little tiny exceptions. And the exceptions were when we wanted to have a large cap growth fund. I said, okay, I'll invest $10 million without knowing anything about Berkshire Hathaway and Goldman Sachs and Qualcomm, without really doing research. I'll invest 10 of these stocks and see how they do. And I'll compare that. That's my benchmark against our large cap growth. So we did that, and I did a couple of little things like that is what I did. And then when Tesla comes along, I said, gee, this is going to be this monster company. And what I want to do is I went to the board and I said, in 2014 to 2016, I bought all the stock I could buy for the couple of funds that I manage, and most of the mutual funds at Barron Capital, which are real estate or healthcare or fintech or emerging markets or small cap, they can't own Tesla. And so I and a couple guys that could own it, I tried to persuade them and I wasn't successful. So I said, I'm not just taking anyone's opportunity. If I invest in this, I'm not going to do it personally, but I'd like to take $50 million on behalf of Barron Capital and invest it in Tesla. And I think I can make $1 billion on it, and I can afford to lose $50 million. It wouldn't be pleasant, but I can afford to lose it. But I can't afford not to make $1 billion. And if I do make it, I'll give some of the profit to people who work at Barron Capital. In addition, that Barron Capital will just be stronger, and my goal is to make it last for 100 years. So I want it to be have a stronger balance sheet, even stronger than it does now. So they gave me permission. I said, I'm committing that I will be the last person to sell. So I'm the last person to buy. No one else is going to buy at Barron Capital, and I'll be the last one to sell. I'm not going to sell anything until all the shares are sold by all of my clients. And the directors of Barron Fund said, that sounds reasonable, and it's fine, go do it. And so I did that, and it turned into, after a 5-for-1 split, 1,000,001 shares. So I told, so when the 500 million, 2 shares that we've sold so far for clients, I haven't sold a single share. The 50 million became 850, 860 million, or 900 million, something like that.
Okay, that's not too bad a return.
No, pretty cool. And I think that there's 3 more times to come from that. And then over 10 years. And so the advantage that we have is that there's hardly, I don't know any people, I'm sure there must be out there, but I don't know people who are investing for other people who said, I'm going to make a 10-year investment or a 20-year investment in a company. And as long as the fundamentals are as I expect them to be, stay with it, and I'm not going to worry about the price in the meantime. And, so that's what I do. And as long as the fundamentals, for here, the business fundamentals for Tesla, from the time we invested in it in 2014 to last year, the business grew from $2 billion to $25 billion in sales. The stock price didn't change. It went up and down, up and down, up and down, and then it went up 10 times. The stock price caught up to the business, and now the business is going to grow faster than the stock price over the next 10 years, I think.
Wow, that's amazing. Let me throw you a curveball for our last question. You ready for this?
Yep.
You grew up in Asbury Park, and years after you left, you were sort of unhappy because the Asbury Park football team ended up winning the state championship, but they were disqualified. And you were so unhappy about it, you bought trophies for the teams and got rings for all the players that were inscribed with undefeated on the field. Tell us about that.
Well, I read the article in the New York Times that described that, and I felt badly. I mean, when I went to high school, it was a minority high school. I mean, it was 50% black and 50% white. And maybe it was about that. Maybe it was 2/3 white and 1/3 black, or maybe it was 50-50. And there were 2,000 kids there. And now there's 1,000 kids when this happened. And it was virtually all minority. And the shining, and it was 18 or 20% unemployment in Asbury Park, and the boardwalk was a mess. And I felt badly, and to hear these kids, there were 2 kids who were ineligible, and they played on the team, and because of that, they went 8-0 or 9-0, and all of a sudden we took away all the victories and went 0-9. And so I said, oh, my God, this was everything for this town. And so I said, maybe there's something I can do. And there was this trophy case in the front of the school where I bought the trophies with the scores for every game that they had. It said undefeated on the field. And then every football player's name I had inscribed on there. And then I bought them rings that said undefeated on the field. And Springsteen read about it. And then he gave everyone, including me, baseball jackets, football jackets. It said the same thing, undefeated on the field. So I got a Springsteen jacket from...
That would be Bruce Springsteen of Asbury Park.
I also have another story about Springsteen.
So go ahead.
When I have my 1980, we have our first child, Judy and I, and we didn't have a weekend house, and we bought this old house built in 1860 on 2.5 acres on Navasink River Road, 920 Navasink River Road, and overlooking Rumson, overlooking the Navasink River, and to the left you saw the ocean, maybe 60 feet high. And so, it, and and it's now 1980, and we paid $250,000 for it. In the middle of these 15-acre estates, Bon Jovi was on the street, and Roger Penske was on the streets. They had big houses. We had this tiny little house, with a dirt basement. And so we have it for 2.5 years, 3 years, and now we have two children. We have Judy's dad living with us, and we have a nanny. And we're bursting at the seams in this house. A guy knocks on our door and says, I'd like to buy your house. And I said, well, it's not for sale. And he says, well, how about for $400,000? I said, well, just a second. And I closed the door and I said, Judy, somebody wants to buy our house for $400,000. So she says, sell it. So I opened the door and I say, you just bought a house. And it turns out that this was a lawyer representing Springsteen. So he bought that house, and he lived in it for, he had a habit by, he just gotten married, and he needed a habit by, I think it was like December 15th or 12th. He wanted to have it for a celebration in December, and so we sold it to him at the end of the summer, and you know, no problem. And then what he did afterwards is that I was in the board of Horace Mann, and he, which is a day school my kids went to, and he would give us regularly when they would have these auctions. I would call him his agent, who turns out now the agent is my friend. But I would call the agent, and he would give us record albums that would say, he would autograph them and say, R-O-C-K Rocket. And then exclamation points, Bruce Springsteen. And I would auction for, $100, $200, whatever it was. I would get, I'd get these gifts that he would put out to raise money for Horace Mann. That's from Bruce Springsteen.
That's great. Ron, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We've been speaking with Ron Barron, founder of Barron Capital. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and check out any of the other 400 previous interviews we've had over the past 6 years. You can find those at Apple, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you feed your podcast fix. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Give us a review on Apple iTunes. If you would like to get my free daily reads, you can sign up for that at ritholtz.com. Be sure and check out my weekly column at bloomberg.com/opinion. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps put these conversations together each week. Reggie Bazile is my audio engineer. Michael Boyle is my producer. Atika Valbrun is our product manager. Michael Batnick is my head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz, and you've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.